This is the David Feldman Radio Network.
Well, this is exciting. Please welcome comedian, writer.
No, start. It's comedian.
Please welcome comedian, writer, and female animal activist.
People always say, what's the difference between comedian and comedian? And I say, 10 grand a night. That's why it's so important to pronounce it correctly, my friend.
Please welcome comedian, writer, and animal activist, Elaine Boozler.
Female Boozler.
Elaine, I'm a girl Boozler.
That's it.
Well.
I'm just a girl who can't say no, Boozler.
Oh. This is so exciting.
Thank you. You sound overwhelmed.
I am. I mean, this is a big thing for us.
Of course, it is. Well, thank you.
First off, your set on The Tonight Show, like 3 months ago, I went, oh, I want to be a comedian.
Oh, too late. You are one.
I want to be a good comedian.
Too late. You are one.
You were just breathtaking.
Thank you. So breathtaking. So much. And thanks to Jimmy Fallon for bringing stand-up back to its home, The Tonight Show, where it was missing for 22 years as far as comedians were concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just didn't they shut the door on that. And it was the mainstay of not only discovering new talent and breaking new comics, but presenting great comics to America.
Yeah.
And so it just, it withered. And it was just fascinating that a show that had broken billions of new comics over its long history in the 22 years that Leno was the host didn't break one new comic to the country because it turned its back on stand-up guests.
Are there economics behind that, do you think?
No. Comedians were all well aware of it, and I don't think it was economics. I think it was just a choice.
Okay. How many Showtime specials did you do? 100?
Five.
Five Showtime
specials.
Yes,
and I have a box set coming out soon, too.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's exciting.
When will it be out?
You know, it's coming with a brand new CD that was shot live on tour all year. So as soon as I finish editing the CD, and we already shot the wraparounds for each special to show 30 years later, wow. You know, because a lot of them started in 85. So the wraparounds give it a context and show why it was radical for its time and also contain really funny stories about the shows. So it'll be out soon. I'll announce it on The Tonight Show again.
And how was Dallas last night?
Oh, fantastic. Amazing.
Where were you playing in Dallas?
The Kessler Theater with a great friend of mine, great comic Linda Stogner, who has chose to stay in Dallas all this time, but she's hilarious. So I always try and get a female great comedian on the bill with me so people can see that, you know, we're good.
And where are you performing? Because we're all over this podcast.
Right. You're all over.
We're all over.
You go like up to 23rd Street and over to Park Avenue. Where are we on the corner of Rape and Murder right now in the East Village? Very nice. Very nice coming up here. You know how people turn their rings around when they get out of the subway here? I swallowed a huge bracelet with charms on it. I used to live down here, but then at least you knew you were going to die. Now it's like, how embarrassing to be killed, but in front of a Chanel boutique. It's just not right. It's wrong.
Let's plug your charity and where you're going to be in the next 2 weeks.
Okay. So in the next 2 weeks, there are more private gigs. I do a lot of places down in Florida, which I love to do. You know what? This is how terrible I am.
You forgot your phone.
I forgot my phone.
Okay.
But after 43 years, it's like people say, where are you next week? And I say, I only know where I am tonight. Mm-hmm. So I really go day by day.
What's your website?
ElaineBoozler.com.
And how do you spell Boozler?
Well, I don't know. There are so many ways.
Can you count backwards from 10? We're just doing a test. Both of us, as you know, he's got to take a picture.
He does. He does. He does. Do we know him or did he just break
he's
in?
He's our producer, Alex Brazell.
It's ElaineBoozler.com. And the schedule's up there.
Great.
And then it leads to Tales of Joy, TALSofJoy.net. And that's my animal rescue organization going on 17 years.
We're going to talk about that. But I guess I get to meet you, because we've never met before.
No.
Because of Stephanie Miller.
She kept us apart?
I think because...
You said we never met because of...
We had like a Twitter relationship based, I think,
yes.
on some kind of appearance that I did with Stephanie,
and then, yeah, and
who
I,
I'm in love with.
Oh, is she it?
She really is
much too beautiful for radio.
Yeah.
You know, she is so gorgeous you could die.
Yeah.
And on the right side of history.
Yes.
She's amazing.
Yeah. And you are on her show all the time.
Yes. She lives right near me, so I drive over and, you know, basically because she's willing to order pizza after. So, I mean, politics, look, that never changes. But we drink and we eat pizza. So, you know, why else would I go anywhere?
So whenever two Jews get together,
uh-huh.
the first question
uh-huh.
I have to ask is, who died?
Yes, my friend.
Who died?
Quilting Muriel died, unfortunately. She was a wonderful older woman I met in Riverside Park in New York about 5 or 6 years ago. And she just, it was just amazing. I was jogging. That was amazing. I was walking fast. And not too fast. And I just saw this great looking woman in the park with a little dog and a leash, and she was on a scooter and she was doing a big puzzle book, and I live for, you know, crosswords and word games. And I thought, oh, this is going to be me when I'm 70. You know, I'll be independent and have a dog. And I didn't stop because I was walking fast. And then on the way back an hour later, she was still there. So I did stop because I was schwitzing. And I found out she was 92.
Wow.
I know. And I thought she was 70. And we just started talking, and that was that. The next day I went out walking fast again, and it was hours earlier in a different part of the park, and there she was. So it was kind of really coincidence. We talked again. The third day I went out very late in the day, almost nighttime, in a whole different part of the park by the river. There she was again. And we said, okay, this is meant to be. We're friends. Mm-hmm. So we became friends. And just really organically, I started a Twitter account for her. Because she was so computer savvy. She had been a teacher for 20 years,
uh-huh.
brilliant woman, and she would get very lonely when I would go back to LA. And it's interesting to note that all her friends, 80-year-olds, 90-year-olds, were all emailing and sending each other funny cartoons very computer savvy, shopping online, you know, looking at the new iPad, always going down to the Apple store on her scooter. They are, you know, more active than you would think. I thought, because she was always lonely when I was gone, that she would enjoy a Twitter account. Mm-hmm. I said, you put in your hashtags and, you know, other people still know what salmon croquettes are. So you can find them.
Right.
And she just, it didn't take to it, but she loved reading it, but she didn't want to tweet. And I started her off. And then I got so into being 97 years old.
How many followers?
55,000.
Wow.
I know. And she would always tease me and say, you're just jealous because I have more followers than you. And I would say, you have no followers. It's me. But she, you know, she did, there was no distinction, really.
So you were ghostwriting her Twitter account.
Well,
based on your conversations with her.
I feel more like I was channeling what I knew to be her.
Uh-huh.
And also, I do have a lot of old people friends. It just works out that way. I used to hang with Brother Theodore every night in his kitchen on, West 74th Street. I don't know if your followers know him, but he was a brilliant comedian who was born at 85 years old.
Right.
He was never young.
Did he influence Robin Williams? Was that?
Well, Letterman made him a star. Letterman discovered him when Letterman was really hip and the show had just started. And Theodore was, every month he would do one show on a Saturday night at the 13th Street Theater and Typing Service, it was called. That's what it was called. And that would keep him going for a month financially.
Who was Brother Theodore? Because I know the name.
He was a German brilliant comedian, you know, from Germany with a heavy German accent, this very out of control, you know, full head of gray hair, brilliant performer, performance artist. And when Letterman discovered him with his collection of, you know, Birds with the Broken Wings, he had Larry Bud Melman, Brother Theodore was part of that crew, and people, he just became such a celebrity.
But before Letterman, I knew.
He worked in New York all the
time. As a comedian.
Oh, yeah, and he was so well known, but I wouldn't say comedian. He sat and talked for 2 hours, and the reason he got so big from Letterman was he was one of the few that could ever handle Letterman on the show. I think it was Charles Grodin, maybe, and Brother Theodore. That was it. And I remember one night because his hair was so awry all the time, Letterman said to him, you know, being hip and snarky, and he said, "So what is that, moose? You got moose in your hair there? What is that, moose?" And Theodore, without even looking at David, just said, "Oh, why doesn't the ground just open up and swallow you?" And people were in love with the fact that he could. Let me tell you his best thing from his show that I still play in my head all the time. He was so brilliant, and my favorite line of his was, he would say, "Every day before school, my father would beat me mercilessly with a wire hanger, but never in anger." He was just brilliant.
Wow, I'm getting hang on for one second.
And my heartbreak is that. Oh, are you dizzy? Was that too hard?
Hang on, seriously.
Yeah, he's so good.
Sometimes that is a perfect joke.
Oh, he was
perfect.
That is
absolutely.
All of it was.
Sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just saying, when I did my first special, I had a whole crew ready to do a special for him because he had never put the act down.
Right.
And I knew he was getting pretty old. And I begged and begged. But, you know, the distrust that in his life after going through World War II and the Nazis and everything, his distrust just couldn't let him have it. And I begged. I said, "Look, just go to any lawyer independently. Whatever he writes down that you want, you will have. I'm not giving you whatever you want, medical care, yeah, everything you want, all the money, whatever you want." I begged and begged, and he couldn't bring himself to let it be done, and he died, and the act died, and it's very sad to lose.
Are there no recordings of it?
Well, probably not in full.
Was he Jewish?
Yes, Theodore Gottlieb.
That would make him Jewish.
I used to sit. Well, if it wasn't, it was a very good Halloween costume. I used to sit in his apartment with him right around the corner from where I am on West 74th Street. We used to sit in his kitchen and drink wine and, you know, just laugh. And,
wow.
Yeah. And he never, never stopped flirting. I mean, you'd sit there and he'd just come on to you endlessly. And I would finally say, "So what if I say yes, then what? Can we just move on?" Mm-hmm. "Okay, I'll say yes. Nothing will happen. We'll move on and go back to laughing. I don't know what you want."
Can I talk to you about that?
Uh-huh.
Being a beautiful female comedian, woman.
Female woman, female jokes. Comedian. Whenever people say, you're the best woman comedian, I say, I'm also one of the five top male comedians in the country.
I want to get to all that stuff.
I don't really dwell in that place.
Yeah, I know
place.
You don't.
Yeah.
Let's move on. But I have a couple of questions. We'll get back
all right.
to that. Where did you grow up?
I grew up, I was raised by the Taliban in Brooklyn, got out as soon as I could, and
I was born in Coney Island.
You're kidding, I was Sheepshead Bay. You were one D-train stop past me.
Well, then we moved to Stuyvesant Town and then Englewood, New Jersey,
wow.
So I don't remember
wow.
Coney Island.
You don't remember Coney?
No.
Well,
not.
The interesting thing is it hasn't changed at all.
Oh, okay.
It, you know, it was just always a pit, and I loved it, and it was great. And my husband, who grew up in L.A. and is so, you know, not used to kind of urban decay.
Right. He grew up where?
Well, in Duarte and L.A. and all the inland empire of Los Angeles. They didn't have money, so it wasn't like the beach. But I took him to Coney Island finally, you know, because he was used to Disneyland where there isn't a gum wrapper on the street, you know.
Right.
And I took him to Coney Island, and it was about midnight, so the trash cans were doubly overflowing. And he looked around, you know, and he had heard me just gush about Coney Island so much. And he looked around, and I'm telling you, we were knee-deep in crap. And people were like vomiting on us. It was so great. I was so homesick. And he turned to me and he said, "Oh, honey, I'm so sorry." And I said, "What for?" And he said, "Well, you know, I mean, look at it." I said, "Bill, it is much cleaner than it used to be." Believe me, I couldn't have taken you here before this. This is good.
Now, I should mention that your husband managed a famous boy band.
He did, a famous boy band.
What was the name of the boy band?
Let's see, Jim Morrison and the Doors, I believe it was. Yeah, he managed the Doors. He fell into that when he was very young.
Let me just pick my jaw up.
Yeah.
Okay, hang on. Okay. It's back-hinged. Okay, go ahead.
I hope he'll write his book, because I had to clean out his office. He was moving, and he was leaving everything because he's just not the guy who takes stuff with him. And I said, I'm going through those boxes, and I'm finding amazing telegrams, because it was before fax machines or computers. They used telegrams of, like, his different kinds of stationery for his different offices, begging people to hire this band, begging them, you know, selling them, pushing. And, you know, it was like nobody wanted. I mean, he built the doors into the doors. He, you know, Barry Jim with just Pam and, you know, that French poet, three people standing there. That was it. He's kind of famous for never looking to make sure Jim was dead. And I said, why didn't you ever look in the coffin? He said, I didn't want to see my friend dead. So, and then he went on to manage bands forever, which he still does. And we met.
Let me ask you a question about this. If you don't mind, do you mind if I ask you about your husband?
No, I was just going to say we met at Clinton's first inauguration, because I was hosting the Constitution Hall Gala the night before the inauguration, and Bill had Crosby, Stills, and Nash on the bill. So that's how I met him.
Hang on, let me put my jaw back.
It went off the hinge. So what was
my question is, I'm going to bring up a name who you were very close to, Andy Kaufman.
Oh, yeah.
And my question is, your husband knew Jim Morrison. You knew Andy Kaufman. Is it true that Andy Kaufman and Jim Morrison are living in Parkland Memorial Hospital with Jack Kennedy?
Wouldn't that be a dream come true?
But we refuse to accept that Jim Morrison and Andy are dead.
Yeah. Well,
why
that's
is that?
Because we love them.
Yeah.
And we don't ever want that to end. So that's great. We both watched, you know, I mean, he had to go watch a movie about Jim that when the movie was over, he said, well, that's nobody I ever knew. And he had worked with Oliver Stone.
You're talking about Val Kilmer's?
Yeah. I mean, he spent a lot of time with Oliver, you know, giving him stuff. And then that movie had nothing to do with, you know, and Bill asked him after, he said, so why'd you tell that story? And Oliver, to his credit, said, you know, everyone I talked to knew a different Jim. I just had to pick one.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty good.
Yeah, I enjoyed my great trivia about Jim Morrison. And then we'll move on.
Yeah. But I'm just saying it wasn't the Jim Bill knew. Right. Bill knew a totally different.
John McCain's father and Jim Morrison's father were both.
Of course. They were both Army guys.
I think they were Navy guys.
But servicemen. Very staunch servicemen.
Both running the show in Vietnam.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
And I think Jim Morrison would be about McCain's age, maybe a little.
Well, let's see. He'd be about 70, 71, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember I read that somewhere when McCain was running. You are very political. Let's talk about your charity for dogs and how people can.
Well, it's all animals. It's dogs, cats, bunnies, rats, snakes, elephants, getting animals out of bad zoo enclosures into mm-hmm. better places. Basically, I've been on tour for 43 years as a comedian. I would always run into rescue people and, you know, go visit their little places. And then I started helping the Humane Society of the United
States. Let's give the name first.
Oh, mine is Tales of Joy.
Tales of Joy. Yeah. How do you spell Tales?
T-A-I-L-S.
Of Joy's. Talesofjoy.com.
.net.
.net.
Yeah, I think .com leads to us too, but it's talesofjoy.net.
I think Tales of Joy actually is where Buttman Goes to Rio movies are screened. It's a different tale.
Oh, yeah. Many tales out there. Well, I started working helping the Humane Society of the United States. And I say that because there are many local humane societies in every city, which are excellent. But the Humane Society of the United States, I don't feel is excellent. I started working with them, volunteering, doing things, and saw that they take in about $300 million a year, which goes to salaries, perks, expenses, you know, wink, wink, blah, blah, blah. They don't save a dog or a cat. They run no rescues. And I went, oh, this is just a money-making juggernaut. And if you send them a couple of bucks, they will send you crap from China for the rest of your life. And that's where your money's going. So I went, you know, look at three old ladies in Ohio save more dogs and cats in a year than the entire bloated HSUS. And so I thought, I'm going to raise money for the tiny guys who do all the real hands-on work and don't have infrastructure or profile enough to sustain. And so that's what we do. We give out money day and night. We raise it as we can. We don't have a savings account. Everything that comes in, dollar goes out. We're totally volunteer. So we spend no money on anything, postage, office, nothing. Every dollar goes to saving animals. And we just support, you know, and fund the tiniest, smallest rescues across the United States. If you go to talesofjoy.net/little guy grants, you can look at the zillions of cities and states we've supported in the last 17 years of all the little rescues that are go around. And everywhere I go, I sell after-show merchandise made for us, which stays in that city. So before work, I pick out, you know, a few weeks before we give them all free tickets to get out of rescue for a night because it's heartbreaking. Right. They come and enjoy the show. They bring all their stuff, their literature. Their own city gets to know them. We leave 100% of the money behind for all the after-show merch, and they sell their own. And so we leave a few thousand a night behind for local rescues every time I work anywhere.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's, you know, we've saved a lot of lives. It's great.
Right.
Yeah.
How many pets do you have?
I'm down to one little fella right now. And, you know, it comes and goes. I foster a lot. We really work on the hard cases. A lot of pitties, a lot of pipples, a lot of rotties, a lot of the big guys that are totally misunderstood. And right. It's the worst campaign against pit bulls, which is so wrong. I've never met a bad pit bull. So it's only
except
bad people.
The singer.
Oh,
he's
well,
good. He's good. He's good. I'm joking.
He's good.
He's pretty good.
But I wish he didn't call himself Pitbull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are dogs from the planet Earth? I mean this. I believe that dogs are aliens.
Well, I believe they certainly are a lot better than anybody I ever met that speaks English. I think you might be right, you know.
I don't
dress them up, and I like that they're other, you know. I don't want them to be people. I want them to be exactly what they are. I don't put shirts on them or anything.
Because they teach us how to live in the moment. And oh, we're having our picture taken.
Well.
Yes. They teach us how to live in the moment and how to be human.
Well, I know that when I got my first dog that I waited years for because I was touring all the time, my boyfriend who I lived with said, oh, my God, this dog turned you into a human being.
Yeah.
So I was pretty, you know, not one. And I just think they touch your heart in a way that is so unbelievable. And they come in with nothing and they go out with nothing. I mean, they have nothing for their whole lives and they're fine with it.
Yeah.
You know, anytime you think you need something – and then you just look at the dog being happy and having a great life, and you just go, wow, it's just – you don't need anything. And the other thing that
excuse me, the sound that a dog makes that just reminds me is when they do – when you're whatever's going on, you look over and you hear your dog go
– I love when they sigh. I love when they sigh.
And you just go, yeah. Oh, right. I forgot.
Well, do you realize – I mean, you do – that – the people?
I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
Oh, I don't remember. I'm 100.
You were telling me how funny I am.
Oh, yeah. You're brilliantly funny. Which you are. Which all your awards prove. But, you know, the Taliban and ISIS and all that, they disallow animals. They have no pets in their culture. No dogs, no cats, no. And really, I was kidding when I said my boyfriend said this dog turned you into a human being. But really, he did soften my heart and make me so much more empathetic and aware. We're fighting these people who have no softness in their lives at all.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, we drop these bombs. We should drop like a million puppies on these countries. A million puppies. And these guys would just be going, I kill you. I kill you. Oh, do boo boo. Who do we do? Do boo boo. Whoa, whoa. They couldn't. They couldn't resist. They couldn't. You cannot. You can't.
I have to ask you some questions because something has happened.
Oh, you don't have to.
I have to.
You don't.
I have to.
Did Stephanie Miller make you do this?
Yes.
Okay.
Something has happened where people are fascinated by comedians. So I have to ask you a couple quick questions. What was your entry point into stand-up? Was it Catch a Rising Star?
Actually, it was – it's so weird because I'll say the improv and then people will think of the wrong improv. But the improv of my beginnings was 1973, Hell's Kitchen in New York, a dark corner in the middle of a million hookers and, you know, factories. And and it's not what you think you know. I mean, that all came later, the glitz and the TV. This was just a little dive that Bud Friedman had, well, actually his wife had the idea because she was
Silver.
Broad. Silver. Friedman. She was a Broadway chorus girl and said, we need some place for everybody to hang out after. So they opened it up, I think it was around 1967, and Dustin Hoffman would come in and play the piano, and Bette Midler would sing. It was just that. It was a hangout coffee place.
Oh, so you started in 1970?
No, I think it was about 67.
No, you
actually
started in...
I started in 73. Yeah.
Okay. Why?
The doorman before me was Danny Aiello, mm-hmm. the actor, and then... I came in to be a waitress. I was just desperate to make a living in any way possible.
No, you're too funny and you're too great a joke writer.
Well, not then.
Yes, you are.
I was
a kid. Were you born funny?
I think I was born with a very specific skewed view, and that's really what comedy is. It's not about being funny. It's about a skewed take on things.
But do you think it was just a coincidence
that I ended up there?
Yeah.
Well, is there any coincidence in life? I mean, I think you eventually get where you're supposed to be going, whether you go there purposely or accidentally. And I was just going there to be a waitress. I had been fired from every day of the week in New York City. There was a Wednesdays, there was a Tuesdays, there was a Fridays. If there had been months, I would have been fired 12 more times. I was the worst waitress in the history of the food service industry. There are people still waiting for forks from 1973. I would bring snails. They had snails, and I would bring the clippers so much later that they had made jewelry out of the shelves. I mean, I was the worst waitress, and I was so beaten.
Snails being served by somebody who's as slow as a...
Yeah, exactly.
Do you remember the first time you went up on stage? I know these are difficult questions, but that you don't want to answer. I'm going to plow through them.
No, you're just asking me to remember something that happened 150 years ago. That's the problem.
What? Because I'm curious, do you remember your first jokes,
I remember everything. I basically, tried to sing, not to be a singer, but I had my first jobs before this were just auditioning for, little mm-hmm. reviews that would work around the country or whatever. And so I got a job in a review called Jump for Joy, which played the Lucayan Beach Hotel in the Bahamas for 6 months. And I was 17 or 18. And so I got to live in the Bahamas for 6 months and sing and dance in this silly little show.
Did your parents approve of this?
I have no idea, and it doesn't interest me at all. I got to live there, and then I came back to New York.
17?
Yeah. Yeah, I was out of high school. I didn't really graduate. In those days, they had what they would call a general diploma or an academic diploma. Academic diploma means you went to high school. General diploma means we saw you once, we need the chair. Get out. So that's what I got and just started.
17 is young.
Well, I get out at 16 because my birthday's in the summer. So I was 16. So I just...
And who were you living with?
Just friends, different places, different
floors.
Is it
true Andy Kaufman convinced you to become a stand-up comedian?
Yeah, that is true. And then I lived at his house for a long time. Then I got an apartment in Greenwich Village with my hostessing money, and he lived with me for 2.5 years. And it was maybe the greatest 2.5 years of my life.
Okay, I have to stop you because Andy Kaufman, there was nobody. There is nobody like
yeah.
Andy Kaufman.
I'm glad that people love him so much and, want to say that he's alive and keep everything going.
Yeah.
And, nothing bothers me about him. That, in other words, whatever you want to say, where he is, I'm just happy it lives, know. There's a couple of people who trade on Andy's, deceased body for their own profit, and that mm-hmm. makes me sad. And I hope people, and I say this all the time, if you think you might be a fan of his or love him, don't read anything written about him, just because of the books, in my opinion, are, don't do him a great service at all. I never cooperated with any of them, ever. They never
There's one movie.
I'm just saying, please go to his work, his actual, videoed work, and just go to the source, and then you can enjoy him. Don't listen to other people.
I used to smoke a lot of dope and drink, and I remember my friend.
No, you're the one.
My friend Mark Dawson showed me a video of a talk show Were you?
Oh, the High Desk?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great, and isn't it?
It was amazing. Yeah, what was that show?
We wrote that together. It was the last thing he got to do. It was a year before he died. PBS Soundstage gave him an hour special. You know, they would do Soundstage. So it was Soundstage Andy Kaufman. And he called me and he was really fed up with the negative people in his life and the users. And he said, look, I have an hour. And, you know, we used to come up with all our stuff together in the 70s. I'd like you to write this with me. And I said, I'm on the road the whole time. He said, well, I'll come on the road with you. Mm. And because even after we didn't live together anymore in the 70s, we were best friends for the whole next 12 years. So he came on the road and I would be, you know, headlining these theaters and my name would be huge, you know, next door. And then we'd go into the restaurant and they'd say, we're closed. And I'd say, but look, I'm right next door. My name is this, you know, can't we just, no, we're closed. And then he'd come in from behind me and they'd go, oh, what do you want to eat? And I said, wait a minute.
What's so interesting? Interesting, but this is a compliment. But you're not anything like Andy Kaufman. You people come see Elaine Boozler and they walk out going, "That was fantastic! I laughed."
Well, so they did that with Andy.
Well, you know, Andy kind of ruined my stand-up career because I loved Andy Kaufman and I. I'm of the school of who says comedy has to be fun.
But it was fun.
It was fun, but not for everybody.
But it was. He never let it go in the end. He always, and no matter what happened, at the end, you got it. And you, I mean, I have never in my, look, I was the doorman after Danny Aiello for 2.5 years mm-hmm. in that club. So for 7 nights a week, 8 hours a night, I watched everyone. That's why I know every act ever done in those years. I can tell you anybody's stuff. I watched him do stuff that I never heard audience response like this before or since ever. And people would be drained and soaked and so happy. It was like the most life-changing. It's like you got a massage and you laughed and they just, you know, stumble out like, what? But loving it. I mean, people misunderstand. They think there's a meanness in comedy. This was the kindest, sweetest human being. He never had said a bad word about a living person, anyone. He was such a fan of everyone. He had such childlike delight in everything. And people who misinterpret it and think they're going to be edgy and mean and fool everyone, that's not Andy Kaufman. And I'm exactly like Andy because he taught me what the basis of really giving is.
Is it fair to say that sometimes it didn't always go over?
It never didn't work, no matter what it took.
Well, I mean, but, you know, Tony Clifton, I thought, you know, funniest thing in the world, but part of the joy of Tony Clifton was that he antagonized the crowd.
Yes, but who's saying it did? But he always got his comeuppance because he always got pinned by the woman. He always made sure that it worked out. And I think the saddest thing that ever happened was the fact that Bob Zmuda goes around doing this disgusting, vile, ugly version of Tony Clifton now that people who don't know the original Tony Clifton think was Tony Clifton, and it wasn't. Andy never cursed. Tony Clifton never cursed. That was the beauty of it. He's this terrible, mean guy, and you can say anything now. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, his worst thing was, listen, darn it. You know, that's what's hilarious. And here's Mood is playing this drunk, stone, filthy, disgusting pig that had nothing to do with Tony Clifton. And I, again, urge people to go to the original footage and stay away from people just trying to make a nickel on
people
on
don't
Andy's.
Like Bob Zmuda.
Well,
why is that? We don't want to talk about Bob Zmuda. Can we talk about unionizing comedians?
Well, that didn't work. That never worked. they tried it in the 80s. We all tried in the 80s. But, you know, it's like herding cats. It just doesn't happen. You know, it's just something that doesn't happen.
And there are still scars from that.
From the strike in the early days?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was a terrible time. But
Were you in L.A. or New York at the time?
I was in L.A. I was on the picket line. I mean, there are pictures all over of us holding signs, you know, no yucks, no bucks. And,
right.
I mean, no bucks, no yucks and all that. And we, you know, we worked at the Comedy Store and the Improv for free forever. And they kept saying, it's just a college. It's just a showcase.
Right.
And I thought, well, you know, you need a place to be bad. Okay, that's good. We'll do that. And then the Comedy Store opened what used to be Ciro's nightclub, huge, 400-seater, named it the Main Room, and put out the edict that if you were booked there for the weekend, you had to dress up like in Las Vegas. You couldn't try material. You had to do a real Las Vegas show. And they were put the first cover charge on ever, which I think was 10 bucks at the time. Gas had just gone up to $1 a gallon. We were eating, you know, believe me, we had nothing. And we went, wait a minute, it's one thing to be going to college, as they kept calling it, but this is a major, major, you know, money-making enterprise here. With
sounds exactly like college. Everybody's making money.
Well, you're right.
You're going into debt.
We had to play football. It was horrible. So we just asked for a couple of bucks a set. We asked for gas money, and they said no. And so we struck, which was amazing.
Right.
And
was Tom Dreesen the mensch and all that?
Oh, absolutely. He was a mensch.
Tell me about
there.
Tom Dreesen.
Tom Dreesen is a great guy who worked his way up from nothing and from, you know, Harvey, Illinois, as he'll tell you. And he was one of the first black and white comedy act, Tim and Tom, in the 60s. And it was Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen, and they were Tim and Tom, and they played the Chitlin Circuit because you couldn't get into white clubs if you had a black partner. And so he really walked the walk. And
with the strike, he kind of came out of it smelling like a rose.
Well, why wouldn't he? I mean, he did so much organizing, and he was one of the grown-ups among us.
Right.
And he did a lot to try and facilitate a good outcome, as did we all, but he was more grown up than most of us.
Right.
And in the end, what happened was that they came to pay comedians for these spots.
Right.
And we got kicked out, so we never got to work in those clubs again. But it was time for us to move on anyway. And now comedians can walk into any club in the country and get paid and go eat afterwards because there's some money in your pocket.
Right, right. It's hard for comedians to, including me when I was starting out, to grasp the idea that you're in this together.
Well, it's such a loner occupation, it is very hard. But I always found in the early days, the great part of it was if there's a part for an actor, so they want a 5'10 blonde guy, you know. Well, everyone competes for that, all the 5'10 blonde guys. Comedy, it's 52 weeks a year of putting someone in your club.
Mm-hmm.
All my jobs came from the comedian who was there the week before. Well, you should use Elaine. Oh, okay.
Right.
I mean, we all supported each other and recommended each other because there was a need for it, and you're not competing with other comedians.
I learned that quickly, and to me it's like baseball. Save my ups when you're playing on a team and you're up and there are two outs and you're save my ups.
Yep.
If you get on base, that means I get to get it.
Exactly.
Why do you hate the Mets?
I love the
I'm
Mets.
I'm joking.
But I do say that, you know, if one man, if you were with one guy, you know, and you told your girlfriends, he said he's going to change. He said he's going to try. He said he's going to do better. He's going to do the right thing. And he kept letting you down. They'd say, you got to leave this guy. Why is it okay when nine men do this to you? Why is that okay?
I'm not a big sports fan. There's a window, 1969 to 1971.
Oh, well, it's easy to like them in 1969.
Oh, no. Actually, when did Nolan Ryan pitch for the Mets?
Oh, God. Well, it was before the World Series, and he only asked to be traded because his wife was so terrified of being in New York when he was on the road that she said, if you don't make them trade you, I'm going to leave you.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I hated Nolan Ryan.
Because he left?
No, because he sucked for the Mets. I remember watching him.
He
had wild pitches.
You have to understand something. Everyone sucks when they're on the Mets. It's only when they get traded that they become who they are. Are you kidding me?
But the 69 Mets, that was the year of miracles.
That really was the miracle Mets.
I mean, we landed on the moon.
Well, I think that had something to do with the Mets
finally
winning. What? I think the moon landing changed so many things in the atmosphere. That's how the Mets won. Oh, my goodness.
Do you think the tides were affected? Weren't they afraid?
Everything was affected. And the Tidewater Tides was the Mets Triple A team. So you know that's why the Mets won the World Series. But everybody got great when they left the Mets. Edgardo Alfonso and, oh, my God, everybody. Once they left the Mets, they became great in whatever team they went to. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But so you're still a Mets fan?
Well, of course. It's like your horoscope. You're born into your team. You can't change it.
Are you able to lose yourself in a game?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, depends on the game. You know, I just call them the Susan Lucci of baseball. It's like they're always nominated and they, you know, you think this is the year and, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, it's your team. You got to hang in. That's all.
Were you harassed during the strike? Is that true? Were there goons who threatened you?
No, I don't remember any
of that. I heard rumors that somebody...
Really?
That's a rumor. That
no,
rumor.
No. Even the people who cross the picket line for their own, you know, gain. I mean, we don't like them, but I don't remember it ever getting ugly. You know, it's just... you never see a comedian... We're verbal people.
Uh-huh.
We'll just, you know.
Well, we have some of our we have listeners who ask my listeners to ask you questions. So there's some questions that I want to play off
because
one of the questions is about being booked on Carson. I want to, and the question is, how long did it take you to get on Carson? But I want to ask you about Merv Griffin. Did you do Merv Griffin?
Oh, the greatest guy who ever lived.
You know, this is what people don't understand. I love Dick Cavett. I think Dick, I want to get him into the studio. I think Dick Cavett is great. Merv Griffin is the most underrated talk show
Absolutely.
Host. Tell me why Merv Griffin was great.
Well, first of all, Carson gets all the credit that Merv really earned. Merv was the one who broke every comedian on television. I did the Merv Griffin Show 5 years before I ever did the Tonight Show. Not only did I do the Merv Griffin Show, I did it every 15 minutes. And if you had a bad set, instead of banning you from the show, he would yell at the audience and go, "You're idiot. She's great. You come back tomorrow night and do this again."
Wow.
Oh, yeah. He was unbelievable. He was a true fan, just the way Jimmy Fallon is. He, you know, people think they're a little bit fawning, and they may be, but it's real, and that's why it's okay.
Uh-huh.
He loved talent. He loved having the job. He was brilliant. He owned his own show. Nobody owned his own show in those days. So he knew he couldn't get fired, so he could put on who he wanted. And if he was your fan, that was it. Your life was made. And there's not one mean or bad or ugly story about him trying to hurt anybody in the business or keeping people off. And he was so open as far as black comics and women and everybody. And Carson was not that at all. So Merv was your entree into earning a living. And he was the greatest guy in the world. And when I did my first special, I'm sorry, it was my second special, Broadway Baby, and I wanted little clips from the different shows because it was an opening about my history. He had already sold Merv Griffin Enterprises to Sony for like $1,000,000,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so I needed a 5 second clip, and Sony owned the show now, and they wanted something like $30,000 for a 5 second clip of me just walking out and hugging Merv. And, you know, I only had a nickel, you mm-hmm. know, to my name, so I wrote Merv a letter, and he called Sony and said, "Just give that to her. What's wrong with you?" And they did. They had to.
Wow.
I mean, that's who he was.
Yeah. He created Jeopardy, and he created
amazing
Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah.
He was going to be the original replacement for Jack Parr and was a true broadcaster. Listen, I'm not going to take anything away from Johnny Carson. I could talk about Carson. I'd rather not, but because they're. But the thing about Merv Griffin, he's so underrated, but you go back and watch his show. It's on Hulu. Some of the episodes are on Hulu. I'm not making this up. Two nights ago, I was Timothy Leary and Henny Youngman were discussing LSD.
Oh my God, that's fabulous!
And, you know, I can't do a Henny Youngman impersonation, but Henny, I saw a side of Henny where he's like, "Well, Henny's a serious guy."
I have some great Henny Youngman stories if you want them.
So in the moment, Merv Griffin. I've learned so much of this show is from watching old episodes of Merv Griffin.
Is that right?
Because he when he t-
Did you learn how to host from that?
Well, I wouldn't say I've ever learned it.
But it did it enrich? Oh, stop it.
But learning to focus on your guest and let it go where it's supposed to go.
It has to. You have to be in the moment. Right. That's what Kaufman was. That's what I learned from him.
What about Henny Youngman?
Oh, well, there are two great stories. One is my favorite story because I'm in it. when I moved to California for the business, I always had a foot in New York, whether it was a friend's place that had a room for me or whatever.
Oh, I thought you meant you were diabetic and you left the foot back in New York.
No. Okay. Nope. Good circulation.
There's an example of a joke Merv Griffin would never do.
No, he might have. He was goofy.
not profane.
Well, it was one of the greatest compliments I ever got in the sweetest way. I would go to the Carnegie Deli every night, no matter what, in New York. I was gigging. I had jobs. I'd drive back, whatever. And I'd end up at the Carnegie Deli at 1 a.m. or whatever. And Henny Youngman came in every night with his entourage of older men. And immediately they would say, come join us. And so I'd sit with them all. And the old guys knew exactly who I was and what I did. And I was new, you know, it was 80s. I wasn't a big name. And they would say, so how was your show tonight? They were so, you know, considerate and loving. And Henny never let me know that he knew I was a comedian. He never talked to me much. And I thought either he hates women comedians like Carson and all the old farts, or he just doesn't know. And so I never said anything. And, you know, I would be in the conversation, but it would never be about me being a comedian. One night they come in and they have a younger guy with them and he's trying really hard. And sometimes when people are around comedians, they try to be funny. And it's kind of sad because they're not. And you have two choices. You could be mean about it or you could be nice about it. You know, I'm always nice about it. Anyway, the guy's really getting on Henny's nerves because it's all bad stuff, right? And finally, Henny just throws his napkin down, stands up and hits his hand on the table and says to the kid, look, I do the jokes here. After me, she does the jokes here. And it was like one of the greatest moments of my life. Now you want to hear a brilliant show business Henny Youngman story?
Yes.
Okay, so... Henny did the same 25 minutes no matter what. If he was getting $50,000 for it, if he was getting $5 for it, he had 25 minutes. It never changed. Didn't matter what you hired him for. And no matter what he agreed to, you were getting the 25-minute show. That was the end of it. So his manager, you know, who I guess Henny was 85 and the manager was 90. He calls him up one day. He says, Henny, I got you a gig. It's a corporate date up at... the top of the Waldorf, it's some corporate thing, and they're going to give you $5,000. He goes, and I'll take 10%. And then he said, oh, great. He said, I'll walk you over, I'll wait in the lobby, and then we'll go eat. So they go to the Waldorf, Henny goes upstairs, he does the 25 minutes for the corporate audience. He does fine. They give him $5,000. He comes down in the elevator, and the elevator stops on the mezzanine, and the doors open, and he sees a bar mitzvah going on. And he just walks out, he grabs the first guest he sees, and he says, take me to the bar mitzvah boy's father. And the guy says, all right. And he walks over. He says, Henny Youngman. And the guy said, yes. And Henny says, you want me to entertain at your son's bar mitzvah right now? $500 cash. And the guy said, wow. And he does his 25 minutes. He gets the $500 cash. He comes down. His manager's snoring in the lobby of the Waldorf. He shakes his shoulder. He hands him the $500. He goes, here's your commission. Let's go eat.
Wow.
These are the stories I love. I have a book that I've been writing for 20 years called Big Fun. It's not an autobiography. It's just all the great stories from the second golden age of comedy that I came up in the 70s and 80s. And if I ever finish the damn book, I'll finally be rich because, you know, it's great. And it's not an autobiography. The first chapter says childhood. It was bad. Chapter two. So 1973. It's not about me. It's all the great stories.
Was childhood bad?
Next question.
Does it have to be bad?
No, I hate to be a cliche. It doesn't have to be bad. I know a lot of comedians with like the happiest childhoods in the world.
Mel Brooks claims.
Jerry Seinfeld, Jay Leno, you know, I mean, a lot of happy. You know, this is what I think. People like to romanticize it because it seems like an oxymoron. But I bet you if you went to bankers and dentists and doctors, there'd be the same percentage of bad childhoods. It's just the percentage of bad childhoods in the world. And nobody looks at that. But because it's comedians who you know, trade in being funny, they think it's bizarre if it was a bad childhood.
excuse me.
Blame it on the mic.
Yes.
Blame it on Alex.
I think difficulty in life helps you as a stand-up.
Well, you know, as it helps you in everything. What's the great quote? Nobody ever learned how to be a great sailor on calm seas. And that's pretty much it. If you don't hit a couple of storms, you know, you're never going to know how to save the, ship.
Is there such thing as a great sailor?
Yeah, there are great sailors.
All right.
Of course.
I've been Fleet Week, but that's a whole other part of my life.
Let me tell you, there are some great sailors.
No, but like as a stand-up comedian, I know this is hard for me, for you to believe as well as me, but sometimes I don't kill. And I know.
I don't even use those words. I never say kill or die. It's just not in my vocabulary.
Really?
I don't see it that way. I just don't think of it that way. It's not that to me.
Well, if a joke doesn't go over and the audience begins to dislike me.
First of all, they don't dislike you or like you. They don't know you. You're putting out a product. They like it or they don't. They get to maybe like you as they go along. But I don't think they ever dislike you because a joke doesn't work.
They dislike me.
Really? Well, yeah. You're special.
No, they do dislike me because I can make them laugh, but I can't make them like me. But the point I'm making is...
Well, why do you think they dislike? First of all, you may be wrong, but why do you think and how do you know that they dislike you?
I've talked about this countless times on the show.
Really?
So the listeners are going to get... bored, and we're talking about me and not you. But the point I'm making is that I think a difficult childhood makes for good, can give you power as a comedian, because I've noticed when a joke doesn't go over, I'll go, I know that feeling. Hello, old friend. Rejection. And I'll just plow along.
Wow, you are way too busy up there.
Yes.
You are. First of all, you're not in the moment then.
Right.
Because you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Man, it's like skiers. I watch them go that fast in the Olympics. I go there. You know, I was skiing once and I said, why can't I get it? Why can't I be better? And a really smart guy said to me, you're never going to be a good skier because you think too much. Mm-hmm. And that's stand up too. You got to be like flying. You got to be going. You can't sit there and judge every moment. That's why if they don't like you, they're going, he's not even with us.
Right.
He's not even here. You know, maybe that's why they feel like you're not paying attention.
Your act have a – do you know exactly what you're going to say?
I have no idea what I'm going to say. You could watch me 10 nights in a row, see a totally different show. My act is so in the moment. First of all, my opening is always different. I always feel the greatest opening on earth is people are talking and chatting in the audience, and then the lights go down. They go, I'll finish that sentence later. And you come out and you finish that sentence. What's on the people's minds that minute of that day? And when you come out and you talk about what is exactly going on in their city and what they saw on the news tonight, and you open with that, you're there. You're with them.
Right.
You're in their house. You're in their living room. So, I mean, Andy always said to me, you know, the real success is if they wish they could go home and hang out with you afterwards. I mean, that's the success.
Ah, I got half of that.
they want to go home.
They just want to go home.
I don't know. I really feel for my audience. I always, my only mission statement is to try and leave them feeling better than when they came in.
Right.
I think life just shits down on you 24/7. And if people took the time to, you know, get dressed and take a shower and get in their car and pay money and see you, why would I want them to feel diminished and miserable and hopeless? I mean, for me, there's a certain buzz after a show that's such a beautiful, it's my favorite sound in the world aside from dogs dreaming and going, but it's, you know, the show is great when I always listen as they're leaving and you hear this joyful, like, you know, this whole high thing of, and more laughter because they're telling each other what that's the most beautiful thing on earth.
Comedians tend to be good husbands and wives, right? They have
no. Oh, no.
Statistically?
Run for your life.
I thought statistically.
Oh, Jesus, no.
I thought we had healthy marriages and.
Get out. I used to have, my husband and I fight. I go, you're right. I agree with you. Run, save yourself.
But you're still married.
Well, on and off. People always say, how long are you married? They say, on and off. No, I have a good marriage, but that's because we're both in such phenomenally bizarre workplaces that You know, and we're also old enough. We met, we were both older. He had been married before. You know, we're old enough to understand, leave this person alone when this person needs to be left alone. I mean, it's not a traditional
right
marriage, but there's a lot of joy in it. But I, you know, I dated comedian. Don't date comedian. Run. You know, my girlfriends would say, I can't believe he did this. I said, did you listen to the act? He's telling you who he is.
Right.
There's no, you know, it's right out there. Run for your life. If you don't want to listen, then it's your fault. No, don't.
I can't imagine having a relationship with a comedian.
Oh, no, you don't want to.
Be too needy. Are we needy? I think we're needy.
Well, I don't think I'm needy.
Tell me I'm needy. Come on, I need to hear you tell me I'm needy. We're all
no.
needy. I'm right.
No.
Oh, come on,
I'm not needy, but I am crazy. So, you know, take your pick.
We are needy, right?
I'm not needy. I'm just crazy. Andy was perfect because he wasn't a comedian, in quotes. So all that didn't apply.
Right.
But I think a lot. I think people are needy. I mean, you know, anyone who's not secure is going to be needy.
Right.
You know, and people are crazy. Look, everybody's crazy. A good relationship, just you have to find the crazy. I mean, I think they said it in Rocky I 150 years ago. You know, what did he say? She got issues. I got issues. Together we, whatever it was. Together we. He said, "How do you get along with my sister? She got." Well, it was something like that. But anyway, you got to find the crazy that fits into your crazy.
And what do you mean by crazy, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, let me think of a good example.
What about anger? Let me ask you about anger.
Uh-huh.
How angry are we?
Well, you're
should
lumping everyone together, and there are so many different
aren't comedians, if there's a common denominator.
Okay, let's put it this way, and today's a perfect example. You may think comedians are angry, but I'll bet there's not one comedian who's voting for Trump right now.
Yeah.
And there's anger.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Well, the whole every fan of his is based in anger and hatred. And I don't think any comedian, because we happen to be intelligent,
right,
are on that side. So when you talk about anger, there's a lot more angry people in this population than comedians are.
What is happening to this country?
I don't know who said it years ago, but you never go broke underestimating the American public. And when you sell hate and anger, you're going to get a lot of people buying that. And that's the way it is. And people feel disenfranchised, whether it's accurate or not. There's so much hate and anger in the war. And we're living in the coldest world since Attila the Hun. I mean, you look out at people cutting people's heads off and you go, man, I really hope I make people feel better after they come in. And I don't shy away from anything. I talk about every single thing. I say, you know, ISIS now is so powerful that the only thing left for Al-Qaeda to do is go on Dancing with the Stars.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I mean, you have to talk about it. You have to bring it. There's 1,000 elephants in the room these days. So
let me push back on that. I think, first of all, I'm an Obama apologist. And I think if you look at a historical sweep, we will look back at this time fondly, the same way we look back, the same way our parents looked at Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
That I think Obama, we don't know it because we're in a bubble. We don't realize it, but he saved this country.
Well, what I find phenomenal is that people who accuse him of this and that never give the responsibility to the Congress that refused to let this man have one victory in 8 years.
Yeah.
You know, they call it an imperial presidency because he had to do some things by executive order. They would have been nothing without executive order, which, by the way, has less executive orders than every Republican who served before him. But when people say he's this or that, why don't they ever give John Boehner the responsibility for making sure? I mean, he could have literally said, I have a cure for cancer. And they would have said, look, he's trying to take away your cancer now.
Right.
Really? They blocked him because they wanted him to fail wholly. And so that's where that lies.
Yeah. The first 2 years, there was a legislative record that not since LBJ. Obamacare.
Yeah.
Somehow he finagled it.
Well, unfortunately, he was naive in a sense. And it's funny to say this, but I identify with him in a way because he was the first black president. And I know this, I'm not making believe that I have any importance in the history of the world. I don't. But being a young attractive unmarried woman in 1973 when abortion had only been passed 10 seconds earlier and women were not in the workplace much and people didn't even know what I was doing up there. I had such a responsibility to everything in each direction to not, you know, it's like your parents used to say, oh my God, is it good for the Jews? Because if somebody was terrible, you know, and it was a Jewish person, then they take it out on every Jew. I mean, there was a comedian named Lotus Weinstock who had
I loved Lotus.
Yeah, she used to date Lenny. She had one of my favorite
lines. But that's not her real claim to fame. She was also a brilliant comedian.
She's a brilliant comic. Yeah. And one of my favorite lines on Earth belonged to her. And she said, Son of Sam, when everybody was hysterical in New York about Son of Sam, and her father was reading the paper when they caught Son of Sam, and they said, David Berkowitz is Son of Sam. And her father said, David Berkowitz? Well, that's a funny name for a Puerto Rican. So how brilliant is that?
Right.
So I felt as this woman that, you know, if I blow this, that's it. They close the door on everybody.
Was that pressure on you, really?
Of course it was. Do you know that I'm a baseball fanatic? I know everything. I did play-by-play for years while I was on tour in every city I went to. Judy Tenuta goes on and appears with the Mets in the booth. I was booked for the following week. They didn't like her appearance. I watched it. She was great. But, you know, they're so PG that they didn't like it. They call me an hour after the show and say, you're not coming on next week. I said, oh, but is Billy Crystal coming on in 2 weeks? Well, of course. I said, so because you didn't like that woman comedian, now I can't come on. But all the male comedians are still welcome. I said, I'm coming on. And so that's what it was. I mean, you were always responsible. So for Obama, I understand. He was the first black guy. He couldn't be aggressive. He couldn't be uppity. He couldn't be this. He couldn't be that. It is the hardest tightrope in the world to walk. And the biggest mistake with Obamacare, he was so naive in thinking if he got rid of single payer, the Republicans wouldn't fight him.
Right.
He actually slaughtered a lamb for them to pay homage, to mm-hmm. you know, show, look, I'm willing to work with you. And they went, hey, great. He got rid of the first thing we didn't like. Now let's kill it completely.
Right.
He so naively didn't understand yet that he was getting nothing from these haters. And the reason Obamacare isn't perfect is because he did slay single payer. And it affects
and
us all
option.
Badly.
Yeah.
And it would have been amazing if he just would have kept it in and passed it.
Yeah.
Well, there's my comedy.
No.
How many people want to kill themselves right now?
No, it's great.
Let's all shoot ourselves.
Well, can I ask you about being a female
I don't think of that. I think whoever can carry you out of the burning building gets to be the fireman.
Right.
And if your house is on fire and a woman comes up to save you who can carry you, you don't refuse to get out of the room because it's a female comedian. And if a guy comedian is on stage bombing, you have 10 seconds to be funny. Good luck with, you know, good luck with that.
Right.
If a guy's bombing, nobody says, oh, he's awful. Well, at least it's a man. And if a woman's doing great, nobody says, wow, she's so funny. Too bad it's a woman. You
right.
got 15 seconds and then people aren't seeing you anymore. They're
mm-hmm.
laughing. So
right.
that's it, you know?
There weren't that many female comedians when you started.
Well,
right?
There was no young, dressed up for a date, trying to be pretty one. No, it had been, you know, married women and complaints. But remember this, people say, oh, they were so self-deprecating. It was terrible. No, it wasn't. That was comedy for men and women then. Joan Rivers and Phyllis Diller, who were brilliant, and Toadie Fields, brilliant. They were doing what the men were doing at the
right.
time. Rodney Dangerfield and Jackie Vernon and Jackie Mason, they were all complaining about their reality of their lives, which was hangdog and henpecked and married and blah, blah, blah. When it changed with Lenny Bruce and Richard Pryor and Robert Klein and George Carlin, you know, they became the town criers and it became more of social observation. And that's when I came up and it was Richard Lewis and Andy and Jay Leno and Freddie Prinze and Jimmy Walker and Gabe Kaplan and, you know, Letterman. And that became a new kind of comedy.
What is the, and then we'll move on. What is the best advice you were given about being a female comedian?
None.
And what was
advice.
The worst advice
Nothing.
You were given? Nobody gave you any advice?
The only advice was always negative, and people said, you can't do this. It's never going to work.
And what was the advice? The bad advice?
You can't do this. It's not going to work. Don't bother.
What?
Be a young, pretty girl on stage and, you know, talking.
They told you that wouldn't work?
Absolutely.
Who?
Everybody. Except the male comedians. The minute they saw me, they loved it, and they would always help. And the audience from the first minute.
But the gatekeepers.
Oh, well, the gatekeepers still don't let us in. But from the first second, the audience was right there. The audience, first of all, the audience is America. The audience was always 10 years ahead of the business. Always. That's why ABC and NBC and CBS, which will be gone in 5 years, are now trying to get streaming networks going and hiring every comic they can find, because they didn't see it coming. They never see it coming. They right. never know what's going on. You know, you get a special 15 years after the public is paid to see you for 15 years. So the public loved it from day one. Andy was the best. All the guys were the best. I never had a comedian turn on me. Carson was the worst.
Okay, so tell me.
Why talk about him? He's dead, thank goodness. Oh, sorry. I know you all love him. Yeah, great guy.
No, I'll.
But Andy, the advice was keep going. Just keep right. going. And that's what I say to anyone. Keep going. You know, you can't sing in the shower and get better. You can if you're a singer. Right. You can if you're a comic. You have to go up and, you know, you learn a billion times more from a bad show than a good show, as much as it hurts. You learn very little from a good show.
I don't think it was you who said this, but a female comedian said that Johnny would always open a door for a woman and, you know, stand when she walked into a room. But he never gave her what she really needed, which was respect.
Look, I couldn't care less about Johnny Carson. He was a product of his time. He was an old fart who, with a closed mind, and that was the end of it. The problem was he was in such a position of power that it crippled our ability to move forward, to make a living, to be known, taken seriously, anything. It was horrible, and that's too bad. But luckily, there are always good people to counterbalance that, and there were. And right. so there you go. Larry King, Merv Griffin, you know, that's the way it went.
And
I don't whine and I don't complain. That, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, there were no black people nominated for an Oscar this year. When that happened in my world, I just got better. I just did more. You complain, people turn on you. You just right. get out there and earn an Oscar next year.
Do but sometimes it. Complaining helps, right?
No, it doesn't. It never helps.
Really?
Are you kidding? The first thing anyone ever told me, never complain, never explain. That's the end of it. And that's it.
In show business.
Yep.
But what about politics?
Complaining?
Well, I mean, like, I'm just...
Complaining doesn't offer positive solutions. First of all, it's not like there were 100 great movies featuring black actors this year. I mean, I saw Straight Outta Compton the first day it was out, and it's funny because it was my birthday, you know, and I said to my husband, well, this is great. I'm in my 60s watching Straight Outta Compton on my birthday. I finally reached my goal in life. I'm not my parents. And it was a great movie, but I don't think it was Oscar, you know, Oscar performances.
Right.
So stop complaining. Just go make a, you know, go make a better movie. And people don't want to let you in. Oh, wah, wah, wah. You know, come to my life in the 70s and 80s and see who's not going to let you in. You know, I had 4 cents saved in the bank and I had to pay for my own special because all they kept saying to me was, well, a woman, the public doesn't want to see a woman do an hour. And I said, I do 2.5 hours on the road. Read my reviews. They say it's the longest and best show they've ever seen. Right. Well, we don't want it. Hey, if I complained, you know what? I wouldn't have one special. You don't complain. You go fix it. You go show them that they're wrong.
Right.
And that's the secret of life.
Right. Right.
That's all you can do.
I think a little kvetching goes a little kvetching.
In public? Never.
A little?
No.
Isn't Bernie kvetching? Do we like Bernie?
We love Bernie. We love Bernie.
But Bernie's complaining to...
He's offering solutions. I mean, if you want to kvetch, you got to offer a solution. What is the point of just coming up and complain? What is the point?
That's all I do is complain.
Well, that's why we're in a tiny little room here in the rain.
I mean, don't
you want to be on Lake Como and George Clooney's house clinking champagne glasses with Selma Hayek? Stop complaining, you weenie.
Was there ever a complaint department? I always hear about, like...
In life?
Did any business actually have a complaint department?
Oh, gosh. Department stores always had a complaint department.
What happened to the complaint department?
I don't know. I think the people...
I guess,
they're probably still there. Nobody comes up, and they don't even know it.
I want to... You know what? I don't think I need a priest, a rabbi, or a shrink, or a wife.
How about an exorcist?
I need an exorcist.
Okay.
And somebody to let me complain to. I just...
Yeah.
Somebody has to bear witness to what I'm not happy about.
I totally
about.
Understand that. Get a dog, really. You have to get a dog.
But that.
My friend was getting divorced, and she's very mild-mannered, and he was really screwing her. And so I would be on the phone with her, and I'd go, that, and I would just let it rip. And she'd go, you have to, she called me every day and go, do that again, because I can't do that. And my husband heard me, and he went, you got to charge for this. You got to open a business where people pay you, mm-hmm. you know, to call up people that they want to tell off.
Yes.
And you
yes.
do it for them, because
yes.
nobody
yes.
can let it go like you
yes.
can. I think I'm going to start that business.
That you put the goddamn lawyers out of business. That's because that's what you think a lawyer is going to do for
they
you.
They don't. They just horse trade.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
They horse trade and charge you a lot of
yes,
money.
Yes, they do. Don't.
That's right.
I'm going through something that.
Oh, believe me, I've been there. I had a joke because I was through so much bad lawsuits. I said, "Here's my new law: if you're found guilty, your lawyer has to die with you."
Here's what I explained to my lawyer.
That's how much I hate lawyers.
I said to my lawyer, it's not, you have to go after the other lawyer. Uh-huh. That's the enemy.
Yeah.
No professional courtesy.
That's right.
We report this
yeah.
lawyer to the bars.
Nope.
They won't do that.
It makes me so angry that Congress goes out and drinks together after they screw the public every day.
Yeah.
You know? No.
We're
done, aren't we?
Well, you and me?
Yeah.
No, we're almost done.
Oh, an hour and 15 minutes?
Well, I have three more questions. Like, if I don't get to these questions, my listeners are going to be pissed off. You moderated a Democratic presidential debate in 2003.
Yeah.
On C-SPAN.
Yeah. For the National Organization for Women. And it was hilariously fun. And Sharpton came late because he was late. And
and he was the funniest one on the...
Oh, he's so...
He's a genius.
He's a genius. I did Politically Incorrect with him one night. I did it 32 times before they moved over to HBO. 32 times I did it. And I did it with Sharpton. And it was right when 9/11 happened and all that. And they kept putting videos out. Al-Qaeda kept putting videos out. Mm-hmm. And so Bill Maher says, well, Al-Qaeda put out... Osama bin Laden released another video today. And Sharpton says, man, that guy's dropping more videos than Mary J. Blige. That's how good he is.
He really is. He's so underrated.
Oh, man.
He's so sharp.
He's so sharp.
Sharpton.
So he came late. Yeah, Sharpton. He came late, and I said, well, this is what happens when you take the bus. And we went back and forth for a while, and then Kucinich leaned over and said to Sharpton, running mate. So we were just going back and forth. It was
so
a lot of
Howard
fun.
Dean, Kerry?
Yeah. Kerry didn't come.
He didn't come.
No. There you go. That's why he didn't get elected. I take full responsibility
yeah.
for him not.
And who else was asking
questions?
Oh, God,
it's 2003. Do you know how much I drink?
Do you drink?
God, don't you? Lily Tomlin, who's a friend, was doing a benefit for someone I asked her to help. And so I come back in the dressing room. There's a couple of empty bottles of wine. And she was about to go on. I said, how can you? And she looked at me and she said, how can you not?
Or George Gobel said, I'm not going out there alone.
That's great.
Let's see. Last question.
All right.
Well, the second to last question is, will you come back? Will you do this? We'll do a live show
with
Frank.
With an audience?
Yeah. Would you do that?
Oh, that would be so much fun.
Well, this was fun. This is a big
great.
Thing for us.
No, no, stop.
It is.
Oh, stop.
Okay.
So talesofjoy.net. If you go on talesofjoy.net, we sell so much cool stuff.
Okay.
And 100% of every dollar goes to save lives. Please go on and look and buy some stuff. Or make a donation.
Okay. And are you watching other stand-ups?
Some.
If so, do you ever get Feldman-esque?
Meaning?
Jealous?
Oh, God.
Dead inside? Envious?
Oh, you really do need a dog. Every time I see someone amazing like Maria Bamford or Eliza Schlesinger.
Yeah, Eliza. Thank you for saying that about Eliza.
She's one of my great friends. I love her more than life.
There are, you know, here's, I just want to say, Eliza won Last Comic Standing.
Oh, did she? I didn't even know that.
Now you don't like her so much.
I love her. Why wouldn't I like her?
I'm not making it. Like, I start telling you all her credits and you suddenly...
I did her podcast. I know. You know, I don't do any podcasts. I did hers because I love her. And then I did yours because I knew how great it was. And I actually asked you if I could do it on
you
Twitter.
Did, yeah, well, no,
kind of. I put myself in front of you on Twitter so you'd ask me. But I turned down literally...
Well, it's an honor.
Literally a lot.
Well, Eliza is really, really funny.
Oh, she's brilliant.
She's brilliant. Yeah, and I don't think she gets the respect she deserves.
She will. It takes time. And she's hosting that amazing game show now where she's hilarious. Someone found a way to make a game show young and hip and put her at the helm of it.
What's it called?
Oh. I told you I drink and I'm 100. Look it up. It's fantastic. And she's brilliant at it. And it's an oxymoron to say cool game show. No. Someone found a way to make a new game show hip, young, and cool. And she's fabulous.
Okay.
So there are comedians I love to watch, you know. Man, I was working with Alonzo Bowden not too long ago, and he did a bit, and I still do it in my head. It was so great.
Right.
He said, yeah, somebody got fired for violating the morals clause in football. He goes, didn't know football had a morals clause. Last game I watched, the dog killer passed it to the wife beater. The wife beater passed it to the girlfriend slapper. The girlfriend slapper passed it back to the dog killer. I went, okay, I'm in love with him. That's it. No, there's great. When I see someone that good, it just makes me go home and write. I just want to be better.
I watched some of your stand-up before, and fresh jokes, everything.
Yeah, out of the paper every day.
So what are your writing habits?
Well, I say go home and write. That's wrong. It's just kind of a figure of speech. My writing habits are this. I read everything I can all day, and then I go on stage and start riffing, and I audio tape every night. I find out what's going on there, start to, you know, flesh out a piece, and that's how it works. I've never sat down and really written a joke. Except for the baseball piece, but that was about it.
So the writing is done on stage?
On stage, and that's why you have to. And Andy always said, you always get something if you go on, but if you don't record that night, you really don't get what you should be getting.
Did Andy record everything?
Oh, yeah.
And he went back and listened to it?
Yeah, and you listen to it because you riff, and you don't know what you said. You're in the moment. And then you come out and you go, oh, that's how that worked. I mean, that's what you do. That's your job.
Right. Right. And is there a section of your show where you try new stuff or you just don't know?
All throughout. All over.
So you have to sit through an hour and 15 minutes.
Oh, I didn't say I listened to it every night.
Yeah, that's the hard part.
But you kind of know what you did. You know where you're coming in and what you're looking for. And sometimes like a joke will work and never work again. And you kind of try and find where, you know, what changed. I mean, it's the horrible thing about comedy. It's like guitar playing. You know, you got to tune it every night and you don't tune the guitar and it's perfect. Every night you go, man, I had it and now I don't have it. And it's, you never get good enough to say, well, I conquered that. Now what's, you know, what's next? It doesn't happen. It goes away. It's frightening.
I got to ask you, and just for my own benefit, I have to say this. And just, so I was about 10 years into stand-up, I would say 8 years into stand-up. I wasn't going anywhere. I was living in San Francisco. And I decided to do what you just said. I was going to sit with a legal pad, tape every set and listen to it. And it was the most painful thing.
Oh, isn't it? It's horrible.
It was amazing. Every time I sat down and listened to my set, I got one new joke.
You got better.
And I did that for a year.
Yeah.
And I was on stage every night, and I had a brand new act, and I was fantastic.
Isn't that amazing? And the way to make it less painful, you make believe someone hired you to listen to this person's act and fix it, and you make believe it's not you.
These are the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
It's like boxing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do that, I'm not doing this right. I mean, I'm getting up on stage and I'm trying, and then I get off stage and I write down, oh, that worked. But I record it. And I do record it, but I don't listen to it.
Well, if you don't listen to it, then you didn't record it.
Yeah. Yeah. But there are a lot of people who.
Why should they have to suffer and not you?
Uh huh. And it's what I tell younger comics is you've got to tape every set and
just
listen
audio,
to it.
Just audio, that's all.
Just audio.
Yeah, use your phone.
But I don't always practice what I preach.
Well, you know, at least it's there if you want to go back and listen.
Yeah. That's what stand-up, that's the purity. You know, Seinfeld says there's justice in comedy.
That's That's an interesting statement.
Well, that's what Alex told me.
What did he mean by that?
He meant that
So we're taping two episodes, basically.
We're going to wrap it up.
Don't you love that I'm saying taping? How old am I? So we're
what time
zapping
is it?
Two episodes.
I'm going to take you home.
Thank you. How many pizza places can we stop along the way?
We'll stop at I got one star from my last Uber driver. He said I sucked on Curb Your Enthusiasm. That was his review of me. I didn't think that it's working the fundamentals. And
I do have to come back. I started out with Larry David, and I didn't even get to tell you the good stories or anything.
Okay, you're going to come
They're
back.
All in the book anyway.
You're coming back in May.
Yes, but so say what were you saying?
Well, working the fundamentals. There's justice. You have to be self-destructive.
Well, wait, did he mean there's justice in comedy, meaning if you do the work, you will get the payoff?
He meant if you're a white heterosexual male, there's justice.
No, that's America. Comedy, you have to be a black straight male. There's justice in comedy. That's what's happening.
No, there is justice in that if you do the work beforehand, you know, you tape your set, you work the legal pad, you know what you're going to say, you work the jokes. When you get up on stage, you will find justice. The audience will respond to professionalism, and you're working.
Well, you better be funny too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Oh, that's what I forgot.
Yeah.
Well, you are more than funny. You
yes,
are.
I'm
we
old.
Haven't even scratched. We haven't even scratched the surface. Thank you so much, Elaine Boozler.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
And you'll
so
come
much.
Back. I hope, and maybe
oh,
we can.
Yes.
Meet. You'll introduce me. I do Stephanie's show all the time.
Oh, she's so wonderful.
I love her, but I'm in New York and she's in L.A.
Right.
So maybe.
Well, come visit.
I have a
come visit.
Okay. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.